The 1995 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 111, Are Marriage Ideals in the Mormon Church Outmoded? By Virginia Burgess. Comments by Frieda Stewart.
You can tell I'm not used to these kinds of newfangled contraptions. I'm Marge Pett. I'd like to welcome you today. I'm on the faculty at the College of Nursing and at the Graduate School of Social Work. And I have the pleasure of today introducing the speaker and the respondent. Today we're going to be in for a very interesting, I hope, discussion on my understanding of it was on premarital sex and its impact on marriage and marriage rates and divorce rates particularly. The speaker today is Virginia Burgess where are you living now? From Syracuse, Utah. I was going to say Syracuse, New York. Virginia received her master's degree in counseling in 1970 from the University of Utah, and at that particular point was very much interested in the issues of premarital sex and divorce and did an extensive master's project on that particular issue. She's going to be bringing us up to date on not only on the materials that she collected back in the 1970s, but also what has been found today. And I think you'll see that things haven't really changed, even though some of us think life has changed since 1970, it hasn't. Virginia's a grandmother, and obviously also a mother, a retired counselor, and a volunteer at Sunstone. Virginia's going to be spending about half an hour talking with us about the issues that she wants to address. And then our respondent will be Frieda Stewart, who is one of the co-directors of the Sex and Marital Therapy Clinic at the University of Utah. Frieda is also a very good friend of mine, we have co-authored a number of articles together, one of which appeared recently in Sunstone magazine, which had to do with sexual experiences of married Mormon women. Frieda will be speaking for about 10 to 15 minutes, and then after that we'll have an open discussion in which you can feel free to participate. Without further ado, I think now that we have our overhead, hopefully it works, and we'll ask Virginia to take over the microphone.
Can you hear me okay? All right. I hope everyone has received a bibliography. If not, there's one in the back. If you want to check these sources, I think they're all available at the university library. And there's quite a bit of material I'll mention, and I can't cover all of it, so I did pass those out. I want to welcome you all here. And I want to mention at this time that I have some people that I need to thank for being here. My daughter is helping me on the projector, and she's a senior at Weber State University majoring in social work. And I am honored to have my bishop and his wife here. I'd like them to stand. I also need to mention that he's my son and she's my daughter-in-law. Okay, with that we'll go on. I was calm until I got here, and maybe I'll calm down as I get going. You can't hear? All right, maybe I'm not talking into it well enough.
It doesn't function very well.
Really?
Well, we already tried this.
Yeah, it's on, I think. I also put it all primarily for taping.
Well, I've not got a strong voice, but I will speak up. Is that better? Okay, I'll try to do the best I can. With the discovery of more effective methods of birth control in the 50s, and what seemed at that time to be the eradication of sexually transmitted diseases through the use of antibiotics, a new era of sexual freedom was heralded. By the 60s, this had grown into a full-blown revolution, enthusiastically greeted as the new morality. Those who didn't go along were labeled as enemies of progress or worse, and the debate was on. It was during this revolutionary time, after I had my 5 children partly raised, that I decided to return to the University of Utah to complete my master's degree in counseling. The new morality debate raged on the university campus. We were indoctrinated with Freud's theories about sexual repression, and Albert Ellis's liberating sexual ideas became the gospel to many of our social science professors. I had grown up in a stable Mormon family where temple marriage had been the expectation. And when World War II ended, I went on a mission for the church and then married in the temple, expecting idealistically to live happily ever after. Our children came very fast, and there were many problems and even a few tragedies to deal with. Life was much more complex than I had expected, and I began to realize that I would need to work if we were to accomplish our goals. At the time, I decided to return to school. 3 of my 5 children were already in their teens and beginning to date, and this debate about the new morality, which particularly found expression in my counseling classes, raised many questions in my mind. Although we learned about groups who began experimenting with open marriage, and some who believed marriage was soon to be a thing of the past, I had never questioned the efficacy of the nuclear family. My questions at that time were how best my children could enable marriages with as little neurosis as possible. For my master's thesis, I asked for and received permission to address these questions by doing a comparison of happily married and divorced women. For the body of my paper, I would like to review the results of my master's thesis completed in 1970 in more detail. I would also like to discuss a few more recent studies that seem to indicate similar findings. Studies done by Harold T. Christensen and Philip R. Coons, published during the 60s, indicated that there was a very significant difference between the divorce rates of couples married in an LDS temple and all other couples examined in their studies. Using their data as a foundation for my study, I attempted to isolate the factors which might account for this difference. Since a temple marriage carries with it certain behavioral expectations as required by the LDS Church for a temple recommend, it was decided that examining these requirements separately might help isolate the contributing factors involved in the results. My study was designed to discover whether happily married women and their spouses are significantly different from divorced women and their ex-husbands in terms of the following variables. A, church participation and same-faith marriage. B, type of marriage ceremony. C, use of alcohol. And D, premarital sex behavior. A study begins with a review of the literature already available on the subject to be examined. On each variable, I will first give a partial review of what has already been examined. I will follow this information with a chart giving the results of my study. This will be followed by a review of more recent studies on the variables, if available. Various studies were, A, church participation and religious agreement. Various studies were located in the literature indicating that like-faith marriages, in which both members are either Catholic, Jewish, or reasonably strict Protestant, have the lowest probability of divorce. And this was Landis, Christensen, Winch, and Skidmore had done these studies. Table 1 charts the result of my study. Okay, is that clear now? As can be readily seen on this chart, the differences between the divorced women and the happily married women are significant. They use the chi-square formula for comparing group differences to figure this difference. And it was significant at the 1% level of confidence. Now, I think you can probably understand the chart, but for the tape audience, I need to explain just a little bit about what the chart is saying. Number one is both belong to the same church and both participate regularly. And over under the divorce, there was only 4 divorced in that column. Under the happily married, there was 31. So that is a very significant difference, as you can see. And as we move down, there's different categories. But this gives you an idea of how much difference there was by just church participation. Now, I didn't make any effort to find out which church my people attended or what that. It was just that much. Okay, table 2, the type of marriage ceremony. Table 2 shows the results of a study done by Harold T. Christensen and Kenneth L. Cannon titled Temple versus Non-Temple Marriages in Utah, published in January 1964. The bottom line of this chart gives the divorce percentage for the various groups examined. Now, on line 3, it gives you the total number. There were 1,950 people in this study, and it was done in the Provo area, I believe. The bottom line for the LDS temple marriages was 1.8% divorce rate, while for the total group it was 9.4. For civil marriages, it was 13.4. So the type of marriage ceremony in their thing was showed quite a significant difference. Koontz did a study which compared divorce rate for Mormons and non-Mormons and mixed groups. This is table 3 that I'd like to show you for a minute. Mormon couples with civil marriages down about the 4th line shows you that there were 12.3% divorce there. While Mormon couples married in the temple, there was only 2.2%. So at that time, it was quite a lot of difference for the two groups. In my study, presented in table 4, the subjects, 50 divorced women and 50 happily married women, were asked about the type of marriage ceremony they had. No attempt was made to ascertain the religious persuasion of those participating, so it could have been Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, but they were asked what kind of ceremony it was. Table 4 gives the results. As you can see, the differences here approached the 5% level of confidence, but could not be considered totally significant. She wants me to speak louder. I'm trying. Will that help at all? It doesn't. Does that help? So I don't think the microphone's doing me much good. Maybe if I look up. Okay. The top line, official church ceremony. This was any kind of church, but it was an official ceremony. Divorced 18, 30 happily married. So even there, there's a lot of difference. And the bottom line, which was a civil ceremony, 11 divorced to only 6 happily married. Now, on the chi-square formula, this was only approached a 5% level of significance. So it wasn't as different as some of the other factors. Use of alcohol. No other studies on this subject were located. Table 5 and 6 give the results of my study. Table 5 shows that the use of alcohol by the wife was found to be significant at the 5% level of confidence. Notice line 1. If she did not use alcoholic beverages, there were 17 divorced and 30 happily married in that first category. Line 2. She drank occasionally for special events. 23 divorced and 19 happily married. So even occasionally drinking seemed to have affected the success rate. This was significant, as I said, at the 5% level. Now, table 4 shows the use of alcohol by the husband to be significant at the 1% level of confidence. I can't account for that. I'm just giving you... no recent studies examining this factor were located. But if he didn't use alcohol, there were 7 divorced and 22 happily married on that top category. Where he used alcohol every day, 12 divorced and 1 happily married. And this was significant at the 1% level. Okay, now we go on to the one that I was really after, but I had to use them all to make the study valid. Only 3 studies were located dealing with premarital sex behavior and its effect on marital success. Turbin's study in 1938 is probably the best known. He compared men with no premarital sex experience to those who had premarital intercourse with spouse and others. How's my time? Huh? Have I got 15 more minutes? Okay, I'm all right. He compared men with no premarital sex experience to those who had premarital intercourse with spouse and others. In this study, of the 87 husbands who married without premarital sex experience, 9.2% desired extramarital intercourse frequently or very frequently, as compared with 21.7% of the 92 had premarital sex with spouse and others. Of the virgin group, 74.7% desired extramarital intercourse rarely or never. Of the spouse and others group, only 38% gave this response. It was noted that in the case of the wives, the two variables in question are much less closely associated than with the husbands. I thought that was surprising. The majority of wives, whatever their premarital sexual history, reported little or no desire for intercourse after marriage with other than the husband. Comforting for the men. Locke's study compared divorced and happily married men. Comparing divorced and happily married men showed a significantly larger percent of divorced than happily married men reported premarital intercourse. Intercourse with a few women was reported by half of the happily married men and by 2/3 of the divorced, while 1 in 20 happily married men to 1 in 5 divorced reported premarital intercourse with many women. Slightly more than a third of the married men, as compared with about a tenth of the divorced men, reported no intercourse with others before marriage. There were no significant differences between divorced and happily married women on reported intercourse before marriage. That was a Locke study. Shope's study using the Adams Marital Happiness Prediction Inventory showed a positive correlation between premarital virginity and high predicted marital happiness. It was indicated that virginity was positively related to predicted sexual adjustment in marriage. That was Shope. However, the number of studies examining the effects of premarital sex behavior on marital adjustment at that time was infinitesimal compared to the number of opinions about premarital sex that appeared in print. Particularly during the 1960s, almost every writer had something to say on this hotly debated subject. It would be impossible to include all the differing opinions in this paper. But a few will serve to demonstrate the diversity of opinions that were being expressed even by so-called scientists. It has often, now this, Albert Ellis, he was the most permissive, and I believe he's still around, a well-known psychiatrist and one of the leading advocates of permissive sexual mores wrote, "It has often been alleged that premarital sex relations sabotage family life and keep people from marrying and raising good families. There seems to be no scientific evidence to support this belief, and much contrary evidence which tends to show that individuals who have premarital sex experience marry more easily and are more relaxed about raising their children, especially about educating their children sexually, than those who rigorously abstain." Viktor Frankl, a well-known German psychiatrist and advocate of logotherapy, had this to say. "In logotherapy, love is not interpreted as a mere epiphenomena of sexual drives and instincts in the sense of a so-called sublimation. Love is as primary a phenomena as sex. Normally, sex is a mode of expression for love. Sex is justified and even sanctified as soon as, but only as long as it is a vehicle of love. Thus, love is not understood as a mere side effect of sex, but sex as a way of expressing the experience of that ultimate togetherness that is called love." And that's Viktor Frankl. The Durants are the authors of 10 volumes of Comprehensive History. It was their conclusion that no man, and I'll add women, however brilliant or well-informed, can come in one lifetime to such fullness of understanding as to safely judge and dismiss the customs or institutions of his society. For these are the wisdom of generations after centuries of experiment in the laboratory of history. A youth boiling with hormones will wonder why he should not give full freedom to his sexual desires. If he is unchecked by custom, morals, or laws, he may ruin his life before he matures sufficiently to understand that sex is a river of fire that must be banked and cooled by 100 restraints if it is not to consume in chaos both the individual and the group. And that's the Durants. A.J. Karchev, a Russian sociologist writing about marriage in the USSR, had this to say. "In some cases, cohabitation before marriage may help in making a choice of sexual partner and avert marriages that will clearly be unsuccessful. However, experience has shown that its negative consequences far outweigh those gains of usefulness. If sociology and ethics," notice he didn't say religion, "if sociology and ethics were to sanction sexual trials, this would certainly be taken as encouragement by society of premarital ties as such to the detriment of marriage. Were this the case, the door would be open for endless escalation of standards with respect to the physical qualities of the spouse-to-be, and consequently, an enlargement of the scope and lengthening of the period in which choice is made, which might lead to a gradual replacement of marriage by an endless preparation for it. All this would sharply diminish the moral level of society, for we know that disorderly and random sexual contacts are not only a consequence of moral instability, but give rise to it. Moreover, a long period in the role of bride and groom, not denying themselves the pleasures of trial contacts, might prove, as Engels justly put it, a real prep school for marital infidelity." Now that's Karchev in 67. It is interesting to note that this was not always been the position taken in Russia. After the revolution in 1917, the Bolsheviks changed all governing sexual conduct. Divorce became easy, incest, bigamy, and adultery were dropped as official crimes, children born illegitimately had the same status as those born legitimately, and measures were taken to uproot traditional structure of the family. 18 years after this liberal policy went into effect, the Soviet policymakers were taking a different position. Timashev describes what happened in his book, The Great Retreat. He wrote, "Dissolution of family ties, especially of the parent-child relations, threatened to produce a wholesale dissolution of community ties, with rapidly increasing juvenile delinquency as the main symptom. Everywhere," wrote the paper, "gangs invaded workmen's dwellings, ransacked them, and destroyed or spoiled what they did not take away. If anybody dared to resist, he was mercilessly killed. Sometimes the schools were besieged by neglected children. Other times, gangs beat the teachers and attacked women, or regularly fought against one another." Does that sound familiar? "Millions of girls saw their lives ruined by Don Juans in communist garb, and millions of children had never known parental homes." Now, this is Timashev in 46. Doesn't this sound like what has been happening in the United States? There are many who blame Russia's collapse on the breakdown of their family structures. Is this what is ahead for us? For my study, 50 happily married women and 50 divorced women were questioned about their own premarital sexual practice, as well as the sexual practices of their husbands. Table 7 gives the results of the husbands, and Table 8 the results for the wives. They can't be put on together. Well, I was going to give you a comparison, but as you can see from these charts, the differences for both groups was significant at the 1% level of confidence. The top line for the husband, he had no sex experience at the time of marriage, 4 divorced and 22 happily married in that category. And at the line 4, he had sex relations with many before our marriage, 15 divorced and 1 happily married. And this is a very significant difference for these two groups. Okay, Table 8 was the wife. And while it was different, okay, and it was still significant at the 1% level, it was not as different as for the men. Line 1, there were 13 divorced who had no sex relations, but 30 happily married. When you got down to sex relations with many people, hardly anybody reported in that category. It, as I said, it seems to make a big difference for the husbands than it does for the wives, at least according to the studies I found. In trying to do an update on this study, I found 77 separate studies examining cohabitation. That's what they call premarital sex now. It was impossible to cover all these studies. I did include a number of them in the bibliography if you want to check them. I'll give you a few of the titles to give you a glimpse at what is going on. Cohabitation and Marital Aggression by Stats. Cohabitation and Marital Stability by Teichman. Religiosity, Cohabitation, and Marriage by Thornton. Dynamic Relationships Between Premarital Cohabitation and Illicit Drug Use by Yamaguchi. Determinants of Divorce by White. First Unions and the Stability of Marriage by Schoen. Table 9 gives the results of a study done by Bloom and Associates on two groups of Swedish women. Those who cohabitated before marriage and those who did not. As you can see, those who cohabitated during the period covered, which was 20 years, at the end of the period, there was a 12% greater chance of divorce for those who cohabitated than there was for those who did not. This was a recent study, 92. And The conclusions from this study are as follows. The results of this paper indicate that Swedish women who cohabitate with their first husband and immediately prior to their marriage dissolve their first marriage at a significantly higher rate than married women who did not cohabitate. Although the evidence is too indirect and fragmentary to pinpoint the precise cause of higher marital dissolution rates among cohabitors, the findings are consistent with the hypothesis that those who cohabit may be a select group who tend to lack either the interests or values that are typically associated with marriage. In his recent book, Marriage Savers, Michael McManus, who is a national syndicated writer, he writes in my paper all the time, published some statistics from a study done by Kahn. These statistical findings are contained in Table 10. Okay, I'm on time. This is comparing virgins and non-virgins and different periods of time, 1965 to 69, 70 to 74, 75 to 79, and 80 to 83. Okay, it shows the percentage of the virgins who were divorced or separated, the percentage of non-virgins, and the percentage higher for the non-virgins. And in every case, they were higher, and they were considerably higher. 67% for 65 to 69, 53% for 70 to 74, 62%. I don't know why there was a difference in the different time periods, but this is the study that he quoted. McManus has a lot to say about the detrimental effects of premarital sex on marriage and has this advice to give parents. Parents, you should always feel free to make common sense assertions to your kids about the relationship of teen sex to marriage. For example, when my kids were teenagers, I used logic in making a case against premarital sexual activity. Do you want to be faithful to the woman you marry? I would ask. My boys nodded yes. I'd respond, then you should consider your teen years as training in chastity for future faithfulness. To the degree that you can be sexually abstinent before you are married, the easier it will be to be faithful to your wife afterward. That's McManus. Conclusions. I believe the results of my study overwhelmingly validated the Church's position on this issue as expressed in the requirements for temple marriages. My findings in 70 laid to rest any doubts I had about the new morality and gave me the tools I needed to teach my children moral values using statistical evidence rather than resorting to the use of tactics designed to instill a sense of guilt or sin. All of my children were married in the temple and have been able to achieve happy, stable families. However, the new morality still appeals to many, and the divorce rate continues to rise, even though recent studies pinpoint sexual freedom as the cause. The entertainment world has gotten on the bandwagon, and many wonder if our society will survive the present dissolution of the family. I believe my time's up, and I'll quit there. Turn it over to Rita.
I think it leads very well into the discussion of what it is that you suggest, and I think Rita has some interesting ideas as well. So we'll turn over the time to Rita, and she'll be talking for about 10 to 15 minutes. For those of you who have just recently come in, Rita Stewart is a co-director of the Sex and Marital Therapy Clinic at the University of Utah.
Well, good morning. It's really very nice for me to be here. It's been a long time since I've been at Sunstone in this position. The last time I was the presenter, and somebody was commenting on what I had to say. The few times I have presented at Sunstone, I have really enjoyed the audiences and found discussions to be lively and interesting, and hope that'll happen again today. I don't know if it's coincidental or not, but I think it's very interesting that we're in the weights and measures room. One of my dear friends says, and I think this really talks to our subject today, that Christianity is all about sex, Judaism is all about food. And so we're having both of our Western traditions supported today. And another dear friend has indicated to me that gluttony is the only form of sensuality Mormons allow themselves. So with that as a beginning, I'd like to add to the introduction about myself. I'd like to say that research in the behavioral sciences is not my expertise. I'm a clinician, and a large part of my practice is dealing with individuals and couples who have concerns about their marital and or sexual relationship. So when I read a journal article or I come to a presentation such as this one today, I am usually considering the relevance of the material to my clinical practice. Thus, it's important for me to be able to obtain certain kinds of information. For example, who are the participants in any given study? Demographics such as age, sex, marital status, number of years married, children, ethnicity, religious affiliation, occupation, income, that kind of information helps us to know who the participants are. How were the subjects, in today's case, divorced and happily married women, recruited? How large was the original population pool? What percent of the pool was included in the study? How were the women selected for each group? Were any objective measures administered to the participants? How were the happily married women distinguished from women who were in stable marriages but might not consider themselves so happily married? Now, these are illustrations of the kinds of questions that I'm interested in. I hope to some degree you may be, and that Virginia can answer for us later because she'll have this information about her study. The review of the literature when I read a study is another significant dimension, and I want to know several things. What other studies lend support to the researcher's hypotheses? What about any studies in which the results may contradict the researcher's hypotheses? And how would the researcher explain those contradictions? Then there's one principle regarding research in the behavioral sciences that I really want to emphasize. And that is, all interpretations of a study's results have limiting parameters. So no matter how rational and compelling the data, across the board, cause and effect cannot be absolutely determined. Hence, and this was toward the end when Virginia was reading, that she stated that sexual freedom causes divorce, and that is something that is not known for certain. It's probably more accurate to report that marriages in which there had been premarital sex are associated with a higher risk of divorce than marriage between virgins. And so what I'd like to do today is take a look at Virginia's three variables from her thesis, the three variables that reach statistical significance. When I get a little bit nervous, I need water. To a large degree, the relationships that Virginia found in her data back in the 1970s continue to be supported today by more current research. Variable number one, church participation in religious agreement. There is a body of research that links religious affiliation and marital stability. In our own backyard, two esteemed researchers from BYU, Vaughn Call and Tim Heaton, did a major study between 1992 and 1994 consisting of a follow-up survey in which data from personal interviews and self-administered questionnaires were analyzed based on the responses of over 10,000 individuals. The research examined religious affiliation, church attendance, and patterns of belief along several dimensions. Two of the findings from this study were that religious homogamy contributed to marital stability and that differences in church attendance is an important predictor of marital stability. As my kids would say when they want my attention, or used to say, listen up, Mom. So I want you to listen up here just a minute. According to this study, couples in which both spouses regularly attended church were associated with the lowest risk of divorce. However, couples that never attended church were less likely to break up than couples who were split, if you'll pardon the pun here. That is, couples in which one spouse went to church regularly and the other spouse didn't go. So perhaps we could interpret this as a reflection of differences in value that actually caused the rift. And the reflection of values is demonstrated by the church attendance. Variable number two, type of marriage ceremony. No statistical significance was reached regarding this variable, but I could probably safely say that couples who run off to Las Vegas or Mexico to get married have a greater risk of divorce than couples who get married in church. But unless we did an actual scientific survey, we wouldn't know for sure. Variable number three, use of alcohol. Divorce rates are indeed higher among people who misuse, who abuse alcohol. Interestingly, though, in the 1990s, scientific research is concluding that modest use of alcohol is associated with all kinds of health benefits and longevity. And I don't know how to put the two together. Maybe if we have better health and live longer, that gives us more years in our relationship, and if we don't watch out, it might end up in divorce because we have more years at the other end. I'm not sure how we should interpret that. Variable number four, premarital sexual behavior. Now, as Virginia stated, that was her reason for her thesis, and it's my reason for being invited to speak. There are a number of studies in which premarital sexual behavior is associated with a higher risk of divorce. However, at least according to one recent study, the influence of that behavior on the likelihood of divorce diminishes as the years of marriage increases. Stated a different way, couples who remain married after 5 years are not as likely to be at risk for divorce because of the associated variable of premarital sex. We also know from studies in the last 10 years that couples who cohabitate before marriage are more likely to divorce than those who married without living together first. But once again, the divorce is narrowing as cohabitation becomes a more socially accepted arrangement. In the unscientific study, and I'll underline the un here, actually the unscientific survey that Mary Beth Rames, Marge, and I conducted, and the data was collected between 1988 and 1990, 31.7% of 103 still married women reported premarital sex had been part of their experience. 90.3% of the 103 women reported themselves very committed to their marriages nevertheless, and 87.5% would marry the same person again, thus implying a very high level of satisfaction with their relationship. Now, what's a different way of thinking about the association between premarital sex and increased risk of divorce? Actually, the study that Virginia quoted from in her paper right at the end by Bloom and Associates alludes to a different way to think about this. One might make the argument that a different kind of person, a more unusual, a less conventional, a risk taker type person, is more likely to consider premarital sex and might choose options for his or her life, including divorce, that more traditional individuals would not choose. And so, just in general, less conventional people breach the edge of conformity in all kinds of ways. Also, people who abide by cultural norms get social approval and support. Those who differ must live with more approbation, which may stress the self and ultimately the couple relationship, increasing the risk for marital dissolution. So, where does this lead us? Kind of in reflection, historically, since the time of St. Augustine, backing what my friend had to say, St. Augustine described sexual desire as a disease, and Christianity has been suspect of sexual pleasure, except to endorse it as a means for procreation ever since St. Augustine. And thinking of people in the group today, of my clientele that are predominantly Mormon and reflect the distribution of the population in Salt Lake City, I have some questions that I think about and ask. How do members of the LDS Church who transgress the church's code of sexual morality handle the dilemmas that such behavior may create for their lives? If the morally worthy receive the spiritual blessings of the celestial kingdom, and the sexual transgressors have their church privileges limited or revoked, then there is potential risk for a split within the self, a duality in which there's a good spiritual self and a bad sexual self. How might this dissonance be reconciled? How do good and believing Mormons who have overstepped moral hands heal their wounds? Or perhaps more difficult, acknowledge they have had a growth experience for which they do not want to apologize. And maybe the larger question is, how do we bring our sexuality and our spirituality together, developing congruence and thereby enriching our lives?
Address those first questions you had?
Yes, of course.
Yeah. She asked some questions about how I got my studies. Let me take a minute. Give me the first how I arrived at these people. Admittedly, a master's thesis is not a huge project. It was a big project, but it was done in Ogden. I was given the use of the divorce records in the Ogden County in the courthouse in Ogden, and I used all the people in the process of divorce who were married before after they were 18. I didn't include any people married before 18 because I thought that added another problem, like teenage marriage. So none of these were teenage marriages that were getting divorced. For the happily married, I started out by trying to go from house to house in different neighborhoods, and it was an impossible task. So I designed a blind questionnaire, and I used random phone numbers. I skipped through the phone book every fifth page and called so many. And when I got a willing participant, I gave him my questionnaire, which never revealed what I was trying to find out. Their opinion about it was on family and what they thought might help the rising divorce rate. And they talked quite freely. The very last question was, how do you rate your own marriage? Poor, fair, happy, or very happy? And I found out people would never say poor. They didn't like to say fair. They said, well, I guess we're happy sometimes. But very happy, that was a very enthusiastic response. And those were the only ones that I used. And I had to go through a lot of people to find the participants for that group. So they weren't just, I mean, I didn't use I used my own questionnaire, but my chairman approved it. Is there any other questions?
I guess I'm sort of glad that I didn't learn about this material before I got married, because my husband and I lived together before we were married, and we've been married for 27 years. So I'm not sure whether...
Well, you got me the date.
I guess it was the first 5 years that counted. I think what we'll do is open it up for questioning, and why don't we start over here, and then we'll move over. Yes?
This is probably impossible to do. Maybe you refer to it in Russia. I would be interested to see if they studied a culture, I don't know if you could find one that was consistent, where sexuality would be carried near the connotations it does in most Christian religions, and then compare divorce rates versus a culture where sexuality is so damned, if you would.
Well,
and see if there would be a difference.
Is that for her?
Whoever.
Well, Margaret Mead studied the... What?
Yeah, but Margaret Mead came to, at least theoretically, to the conclusion.
He's asking about whether cultures that were sort of neutral about sex have been studied. And I think Russia might be one that we could count, because they actually really threw it all out. They did away with the church as best they could, and they threw it all out. And it made a considerable difference in Russia. Now, Margaret Mead did, I read a lot of material when I was doing this, but her study in the Trobriand Islands was considered the gospel, and it made it sound like, gee, it was heaven there, and, you know, nobody had to worry about anything. But when they delved into the background, she really didn't penetrate their actual living experience, according to what I read, that she wasn't even penetrating what was going on in their society. And they were a very small communal society, which is, we live in a very complex capitalist system, and I don't think you can compare them at all.
I think it would be interesting.
I'm not sure you can even find a consistent culture, because even with Russia, had a strong authoritarian legacy with pretty puritanical, at least cultural views.
Yes.
Yeah, I'd like to agree with. How do you deal with the singles account? With this premarital sex, I got the church position very strict. But then you get a lot of singles are marrying older, and that's not the reason why they're not married. How would you get that conflict? Is it supposed to be non sexual, or what? How would you deal with the church position and the single?
Thank you. Let me be sure I'm clear about what you're asking. I think it is perhaps how presently are we dealing with this conflict where the church has a very clear position regarding premarital sex, and marriages are occurring later and later in life. And so what happens? And
is it supposed to be asexual or what?
Well, I think that's the question. I think that's the dilemma. That
was my dilemma when I was examining the problem. I was married, but I had five children who were coming up, and they all wanted to go to college. And I really would have liked to just said, oh, you know, it's okay, you know, you don't have to worry about this. But my study, I couldn't do it. My kids married while they were in college. This son, she helped support him through the last two or three years of school. And they've all finished college married, and it isn't such a bad thing either.
So Will's been overseas, and that's just, they're just supposed to deal by themselves?
Well, I think that's the issue. I think that it's a struggle for a lot of people, but there is definitely a position that the church takes, and that most religious groups take. And that's the dilemma that people have to struggle with. I think that the churches are pretty firm on that. I don't think.
Yeah, I think even the Protestant. I read a lot on the Protestant religious terms.
I just want to piggyback on what you said, because being 36 and single, the issue that I'm running into, and it's a very different thing to me even saying when you're 25. What I'm running into is there aren't enough men in the church to date, or enough men who want to have a relationship. And I started dating non-members, and immediately you run into these issues of, you know, here's somebody with a lot of sexual experience and someone that has none. And, you know, how do you resolve these issues? And right now I'm thinking, not to be personal, I'm, you know, in the trade, but right now I'm facing the issue of, you know, if this is a choice that I made to become sexually active, you know, I am going to face guilt from the church. And the very last question that you raised, you know, is a growth experience something that you're not sorry for the contribution about? I mean, all that I'm saying is that it's a very different issue when you're in your 30s than it is when you're, I mean, I agree with you, it's probably good to wait, but college is not very old compared to some of the
single
that are out there.
That's
what I'm saying.
College
is very young, you know.
The voice of reality.
Of experience or not.
Yes, you had a... And then I'll take somebody in the
back. Exactly.
I don't know if my question is tied quite to that, but you gave some data relative to church attendance where we saw that asymmetry of the commitment of the husband and wife, whether they were both committed or both not committed, led to a happy marriage situation as to opposed to where they were different. Is there data that relates to sexual activity of a similar nature? Most of the terms, I think all of the data you presented was for the husband's sexual behavior or the wife's sexual behavior, but is there data where they are both sexually active, both not sexually active, where
you mean with other people or with just a couple themselves?
Well, you can consider where they both had multiple experiences only with each other, or of course neither of them having any experience, or you know, the crossovers of those.
Well, in my study, it goes down the list of all these different types of relationships.
Do you see anything where the similar nature of the two people's experience has a meaning as it did in the church attendance?
The only thing that
one is a virgin and the other has multiple experience, is that...
I didn't examine...
One thing I can tell you about is there was a recent article in Journal of Marriage and the Family by Kahn and London, and one of the things that they found was that, in fact, the relationship of premarital sex, it was an issue, for example, for whites, but not for blacks, for one thing, and also that, again, that as Frieda pointed out, that the that the issue of premarital sex really applied in the first 5 years of marriage. Once you went beyond the first 5 years of marriage, the issue of premarital sex was not an influence on the divorce rate. I don't think they addressed the issue, though, as your point about symmetry. At least I didn't see it here. I don't know if you'd like to.
No, I would just like to make one comment. The person who talked about that reality check, and this is, I just think, is a statement of fact and without judgment as to whether it's positive or negative, that the way our culture is going, it becomes less and less an issue at this point in time because more and more young adults are cohabitating. And more and more young adults have premarital sexual experience. Divorces on the rise in Utah. We have the higher than national average divorce rate. Good Mormons, good Mormon couples are divorcing, but it still maintains that Mormons who are married in the temple, though the divorce rate has gone up for that too, it's lower than the divorce rate in other groups. And so the world is changing whether we want it to or not, and it's not part of our control.
Maybe we'll take somebody from over on that side of the room so you don't feel neglected. How about
Virginia talked about the Scandinavian study where female Americans existed for around 5 years.
This went on for 20 years.
Still, 20 years we had premarital sex. How would you relate that statement to the last few comments that were made on both sides?
Well, that was her observation, the 5 year. I didn't read
that's
about that.
That's not my observation. That's from the study.
Okay.
That's from this particular
that study. Wasn't a study that I dealt with, so I can't comment. Only that Scandinavians have had a liberalized sexual life for a fair number of years. They were really ahead of us. They started out kind of after Russia and went on from there. So it's still a debatable question, but there's some statistics to go by.
I want to thank you very much. I'm afraid we'll have to stop. It's now, according to my watch, we've got about 15 seconds. So I'd like to thank Virginia very much for your presentation and Frida for your discussion.
Thank you.